Greetings and welcome to the Beacon broadcast from Beacon Baptist Church on Kirkpatrick Road in Burlington, North Carolina. The Beacon broadcast is supported in part by the gifts of faithful listeners. If you'd like to correspond with Pastor Barkman and the Beacon broadcast, or if you wish to support this radio ministry, write to the Beacon broadcast, Post Office Box 159, Alamance, North Carolina 27201. The Beacon broadcast, Post Office Box 159, Alamance, North Carolina 27201. Now, with today's message from God's Word, here is Pastor Greg Barkman.
As we move out of Romans chapter 1 into chapter 2, and that's what we're doing now, even though I didn't give as much detailed attention to the last part of the list of sins in chapter 1 that I had originally thought I would, nor did I deal with that last verse in chapter 1 that probably deserves some comment. So let me pause to do that. Romans 1:32 says, "Who knowing the righteous judgment of God, that those who practice such things are deserving of death, not only do the same, but also approve of those who practice them." This tells us that men, in pursuing their sins, know that their sins deserve the severest judgment, know that their sins deserve death. Now, not everybody will admit that openly, but God says that men know that in their hearts. But as God removes his restraint, and as individuals flaunt their sin, exercise their sin, sin flows more easily from the human heart and finds greater and greater expression in human society, then men, knowing that their sins deserve the severest judgment of God, not only continue to pursue them anyway, but they take delight in others sinning around them. They take delight that others are sinning as well. They encourage others to sin. They want others to sin. They want others to join them in their sin. And isn't that obvious? Isn't that a picture of what we see going on in American society today? It's not enough that I shall pursue my own sin in my own way, not caring what others think, but I must take as many others with me as I can. I must make everybody else agree that what I'm doing is all right. I will not rest content as long as there's anybody around me who expresses any disapproval of my sin, or even that I think might be thinking disapproval of my sin. I insist upon dragging everyone else with me, and only when I've got everybody down to the same level that I'm at will I be content. I'm determined to damn myself, and I'm determined to damn everybody else that I possibly can. That's the attitude of the human heart when God has given men up to a depraved mind. Not a pretty picture, but an accurate picture, and unfortunately, a picture that we see working its way out day by day in the newspapers, on the newscasts, and in the society where we live. Now we come to Romans chapter 2, and we find that Paul is still dealing with the theme of God's judgment, and he shows us in the first few verses of the chapter that God judges men with perfect equity and unerring competence. Now the fact is, men do not readily accept God's assessment of human sin and the imperative of divine judgment. They know in their hearts that they deserve God's judgment, but they are unwilling to admit that. In fact, they will state the opposite. I don't deserve hell. I don't deserve the judgment of God. I don't deserve the bad things that have happened to me. And if God is the author of such things, then God is not a good God. In other words, men will admit that they are sinners, the sort of, well, nobody's perfect attitude, but it's difficult to get men to realize the gravity of their sins, the true nature of their sin. Men will often acknowledge that they are guilty of big sins when they are in fact guilty of things like murder and rape, and will admit that such sins like that deserve severe judgment, even death, particularly when it's the other guy who's done it. You find a mixed report on that from people who are on death row. Some who seem to be willing to acknowledge their sin and to acknowledge that they deserve to die. They will say so. Some even will say, I want to die. And you know that that's probably a heart that has come to terms with their sin before God. I suspect that in many cases, people who express those sentiments have been mercifully saved by the grace of God. They have owned their guilt. They've owned their deserved judgment. They're willing to accept it as the just recompense for what they have done. And in some ways, they even seem to welcome it. I look forward to paying the just penalty for my sin. But if they have, by God's grace, come to trust in Jesus Christ, of course, they will not pay the ultimate penalty, because the ultimate penalty cannot be given in life. It cannot be given upon the earth. The ultimate penalty can only be rendered by God at the day of judgment, when he says, depart from me, you workers of iniquity, I never knew you, and cast them into outer darkness. That's the ultimate judgment. That is the ultimate death, the second death. Some men on death row will admit their guilt, but many will insist that they don't deserve to die, even sometimes admitting that they are guilty of the crime, but still, all right, I murdered several people, but I don't deserve to die for that. I had reasons. I can justify what I did. I am not willing to admit the full impact of what I did, the full gravity of my sin and crime. And so men many times will admit that God's wrath should fall upon those who are guilty of big sins, but very few men readily admit that God's wrath deserves to fall upon men who are guilty of what they consider to be lesser sins, such as envy and pride and sins like that. You tell me that that deserves a judgment of God? Oh, I would say not, because after all, as men view it, hey, that's just the way everybody is. That's the human condition. Everybody's that way. Everybody does that. Nobody's perfect. And the fact of the matter is, that's all true. But that doesn't mean that those sins don't deserve the judgment of God. It means that everyone deserves a judgment of God, but people don't tend to see it that way. In short, men do not accept God's perspective concerning the seriousness of sin. Like the school child who cajoles his parents to permit questionable behavior because, hey, Mom, everybody's doing it. We respond to God about our sins. Hey, God, it's no big deal. Everybody's doing it. And we figure sometimes that as long as we don't do the biggies, the really serious sins, that we're okay because we're no worse than the average guy. We're like everybody else. And so if we are as good as most of the people we know, and even better than some, and we all know people that are worse than we are, and that is used by the sinner to encourage him that he's not so bad, we feel that we're fine, that God will judge us with leniency. We tend to think like the cynical philosopher that I heard one time who said, God will forgive because that's his business. That's his trade. That's what God does. That's who he is. He's there to forgive. But in Romans chapter 2, the Apostle Paul knocks the props out from under such reasoning and shows us the extent of our guilt, all of us, and the basis of God's searching judgment upon all human sin, the small as well as the great. And here's what it sounds like. Romans chapter 2. Therefore you are inexcusable, O man, whoever you are who judge, for in whatever you judge another, you condemn yourself, for you who judge practice the same things. Therefore, here's a conclusion, basically, based actually upon what has already been discussed in chapter 1. Therefore, you are inexcusable, O man, whoever you are, that judgest. And this is going to show us the justice of God's condemnation. God's judgment upon sin was the main point of Romans chapter 1, verses 18 and following. And it will continue on into chapter 3. But the emphasis here upon man's universal need for the gospel is laid before us by dealing with the serious reality and extent of sin in the life of every person. Paul is not dealing with man's sin superficially and lightly, as it is commonly dealt with today by many preachers, many churches, many Christians, many church growth experts. Paul is dealing with it in a different way. And in chapter 1, verses 18 through 32, he dealt with the guilty pagan, the guilt of those who seem to evidence no knowledge of the true God, and he showed that they really do have more knowledge of God than you might think. They actually know a great deal about the true God, verses 19 through 21, but they have deliberately rejected the truth which they possess. And therefore God gave them over to sinful corruption, a judgment, because of their rejection of truth, but they continue in their open pursuit of sin, in spite of their knowledge of God's severe, just judgment upon those who commit such sins, and they encourage others to do the same. That's the way Paul wrapped up his summary of chapter 1 when he came to verse 32. Now he is dealing in chapter 2 with the guilty non-pagan. You see, there were many that Paul knew, religious Jews, for example, who would agree with the verdict of chapter 1, that men have rejected the knowledge of God which they had and have pursued sin, and that they are being justly judged by God because of their sin. There are many who would agree with that verdict, but would reject the verdict that Paul is going to give in chapter 2, which is the universal guilt of all mankind. Men tend to put themselves in the category of the good people who don't deserve the judgment of God, and to see only other people in the category of the bad people who do deserve the judgment of God. So Paul opens the chapter by targeting a category of people which actually includes all of us. O man, whoever you are, the judges. In other words, anybody who passes judgment upon another individual. Anyone who judges others based upon any concept of right and wrong. That's who I'm talking to. And when you judge somebody else, you condemn yourself, as Paul is going to show us here. That's what he's showing. When you say, that person should not have lied, you are showing that you know the difference between right and wrong. You know that lying is wrong, and therefore you condemn yourself when you lie. Now, when you lie, you generally have a ready justification why it was okay in your case, but the fact that you judged another person for lying shows that you know lying to be wrong, and what you actually do is, by your own words, condemn yourself, because your own words have made it plain that you know lying to be wrong. Therefore, there's no excuse when you lie. That's what Paul is going to show us here. We'll see it more clearly as we move on tomorrow. Until then, Greg Barkman saying good day. May God give you his eternal peace.